Due to the graphic nature of this murder case, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder, suicidal ideation, and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
In the early 20th century, New York's newspaper market was booming. There were dozens of daily papers for the city's population to choose from, and it was getting harder for publishers to cut through the competition. So some papers started focusing on stories that were sure to catch readers' attention.
These new tabloids, nicknamed jazz journalism, focused on sensational stories of crime and sex. The truth was sometimes stretched or disregarded entirely in favor of catchy, engaging articles.
And despite the fact that they were an unreliable news source, it worked. Tabloids like the New York Daily News were soon flying off the shelves.
In 1920, the tabloids stumbled upon their ideal story. A famous Manhattan playboy named Joseph Bowne Elwell was found dead, and the investigation into his murder uncovered a near-perfect combination of sex, crime, and scandal.
Publishers were desperate for any and all details on the case, and the tabloids began printing just about any whisper or rumor that they could get their hands on. But the tabloids' plan to sell papers had some serious consequences.
Because, as it turned out, the police were reading them too.
The conflicting reports about Joseph's death distracted and confused the investigators, and eventually brought the entire murder case crashing down.
This is Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, a Spotify original from Parcast. I'm your host, Carter Roy.
And I'm your host, Wendy McKenzie. Every Tuesday, we dive into the world of a real unsolved murder and try to solve the case.
You can find episodes of Unsolved Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is our final episode on the mysterious murder of Joseph Bowne Elwell. Last week, we discussed Joseph's rise to fame and fortune as a card player. This week, we'll cover the contradictory interviews and conflicting news reports that ultimately doomed the investigation into Joseph's murder.
We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
The NBA playoffs are here. And with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
In In 1920, 47-year-old Joseph Bowne Elwell was the most famous bridge player in the world. He was well known in elite New York City circles as a fashionable and handsome ladies' man.
But on the morning of June 11th, 1920, Joseph looked far from beautiful. When his housekeeper, Marie Larson, walked into his Manhattan apartment, she was shocked to find Joseph without his toupee or dentures and covered in blood.
Joseph's body was propped up in a plush velvet chair with the blood-stained morning mail on his lap. He had a bullet hole right in the center of his forehead, but amazingly, he was still breathing.
Marie immediately ran out of the house looking for help.
Hurry! Call the police! Something has happened to Mr. Elwell!
The housekeeper managed to flag down a police officer at a nearby drugstore. As the cop followed her into Joseph's brownstone, he tried to get Marie to tell him what had happened. She was in too much of a hurry to explain.
Once the pair arrived in Joseph's drawing room, the police officer somehow didn't notice that Joseph was covered in blood. Thinking the man had simply fainted, the cop recruited a milkman from outside to help carry him to bed.
It wasn't until the officer lifted Joseph's limp torso that he noticed the hole in Joseph's skull.
Okay, lift on three. One, two...
Wait! Look here at his forehead. Is that a wound?
You'd know better than me, officer. I'm just a milkman.
Is that a bullet hole?
Who do you think I am? Ask me about a cow, sure, I can tell you about cows. Want to know about pasteurization? No problem. But then you drag me in here and start grilling me about guns? Well then, listen, mister—
We better leave him where he is. Ma'am, do you have a telephone? We need to call an ambulance!
Detectives were already swarming Joseph's brownstone by the time the ambulance arrived to pick up his body. Police officials initially thought Joseph's gun wound was self-inflicted, but there was no weapon near the body. That could only mean one thing. This was attempted murder.
The first major clue was discovered underneath Joseph's chair, the cartridge of a .45 caliber bullet.
Detectives searched Joseph's bedroom. A toupee sat on a marble model of Joseph's head. A set of false teeth was submerged in a glass of water by the bed. His dressing table was covered by expensive makeup and cologne, and his closet was filled with hundreds of handcrafted garments. He seemed to be obsessed with his appearance.
Detectives immediately noticed that there was plenty of money and jewelry out in the open, but nothing seemed disturbed. This didn't look like a simple robbery.
Meanwhile, the hairless and toothless Joseph was booked into Bellevue Hospital at 9:19 a.m., The doctors could do little to help him. The iconic bridge player died less than an hour later.
This had officially become a murder investigation.
When conducting a thorough examination of the crime scene, Captain Thomas Walsh noticed that Joseph's chair was set strangely far away from the drawing room's wall. Marie Larson confirmed that the chair had been moved. Walsh speculated that the chair had been scooted out so that the murderer could hide behind it.
Walsh's detectives also found two cigarette butts in the room. One near Joseph's body had been lit on the wrong side, like the victim had tried to smoke it while distracted and scared.
The other cigarette butt seemed like an even bigger clue.
Captain Walsh! Captain Walsh! Over here!
What do you have for me, detective?
Another cigarette here on the mantelpiece, and this one's a different brand than Mr. Elwell's.
Then it must be the killer's. Let me see. It's still wet with spit. The murder must have happened just before Mrs. Larson discovered Mr. Elwell's body.
But the truth of the matter was much more benign. The cigarette was almost certainly left by one of the many detectives who were examining the room. The evidence didn't prove anything, aside from the fact that the investigation was disorganized from the very start.
Captain Walsh kept searching for clues where there weren't any. Walsh was convinced that a letter, which was found open on Joseph's lap, would be central to the investigation.
Instead, the blood-soaked note was just about an innocuous business matter. It was a routine update from Joseph's horse trainer about his racehorses in Kentucky.
But although the letter itself was not important, the fact that Joseph had been reading it at the time of his death was. One of Walsh's detectives realized that they could create a time frame for the murder by figuring out when the mail was delivered.
In those days, mail was delivered to homes several times a day. The detective soon tracked down Joseph's mail carrier, who was passing out mail nearby.
244 West 17th Street. That's Mr. Joseph Elwell's residence.
You have that memorized?
Kid, I've been a postman in these parts for about 25 years. I always remember an address.
About when would you say was your last delivery at Joseph's place?
I was on the 200 block of 17th around 7:20 a.m. Now that you mention it, something was odd this morning.
What's that?
His storm door was unlocked. I almost always deliver his mail by sliding it under his door, because it's always locked. Except for today. So I placed the mail in front of his interior door.
The mail carrier's statement set up an intriguing mystery. Joseph's housekeeper had found the storm door locked when she arrived at 8:35 a.m., that meant that the killer must have locked the entryway sometime between 7:20 and 8:35. And more importantly, they must have had access to a set of keys.
Marie Larson insisted that Joseph only had two sets of keys, one for her and one for himself. But when the police questioned Joseph's chauffeur, they heard another story. Apparently, Joseph had several sets of keys that he shared with his many female lovers. And he often left keys under the mat for his mistresses.
After further questioning, Marie Larson remembered that she had recently left a set of keys under the mat for William Pendleton, Joseph's ex-business partner. The men had once owned racehorse stables and remained on seemingly friendly terms after William left the business. Marie claimed she hid the keys for William around Christmas because he was visiting Manhattan while Joseph was away.
But William Pendleton was surprisingly defensive when he was confronted with Marie's claim.
Perfectly absurd. Mrs. Larson doesn't know what she's talking about. I have not seen Elwell for 8 months or more. I never was very intimate with him, for I am a family man and could not afford to run about with him.
Meanwhile, back at the scene of the crime, detectives continued questioning Marie Larson and other witnesses. They still didn't know where Joseph had been the night before his murder. All they knew was that it was somewhere formal. Joseph's unfolded tuxedo was draped by his bed.
They didn't have to wait long for answers. Before news of Joseph's death even went public, a woman named Viola Krause appeared at the front door. And as it turned out, Viola was one of the last people to see Joseph alive.
An accident? What do you mean, Mrs. Larson?
Oh, Miss Krause, it's just awful. Mr. Elwell has been shot.
Shot?
He was taken to the hospital less than an hour ago.
Do you mind if I come in?
The police are here, so I'm not sure.
I just need to run upstairs for a moment.
Well,
it will only be a second. Pardon me.
Viola rushed up to Joseph's bedroom, where she was startled to see several detectives combing through Joseph's belongings. She quickly left the way she came.
Viola's behavior seemed suspicious. Detectives assumed that she had been trying to hide her affair with Joseph, but it was also possible she was trying to tamper with evidence. Either way, whatever Viola was planning would have to wait.
Sometime after 10 a.m. on June 11th, Joseph Elwell's body was moved from Bellevue Hospital to the city morgue. The city's chief medical examiner, Dr. Charles Norris, conducted the autopsy. That morning, Dr. Norris officially put the rumor to rest that Joseph died by suicide. He ruled that
Elwell was drilled through the head, right in the center of his forehead. There were about 3 inches of powder grains around the wound, but no powder burns, indicating that the gun had been held at least 4 or 5 inches away. He could never have inflicted that wound himself. No man can hold a .45 caliber gun that far away and shoot himself through the head.
Dr. Norris guessed that Joseph had been shot at around 8:20 a.m. only 15 minutes before Marie Larson arrived at the crime scene.
Marie Larson had been within minutes of crossing paths with the murderer, but the truth of the matter was, Marie likely had crossed paths with the killer already, because whoever pulled the trigger was likely one of his so-called friends.
Coming up, we'll explore the police's attempt to infiltrate Manhattan's elite and the many possible suspects they found along the way.
Hi, it's Vanessa from Parcast, and I'm here to tell you about my new 10-episode limited series, Obituaries. They're some of the most iconic figures of all time, celebrated in death for their individual achievements and impact on society. But in life, the relationships they kept tell a different story, one of unexpected connections that yielded extraordinary change. Every Wednesday on Obituaries, join my co-host Carter and me as we explore the shared legacies of prolific pairs from the past. From the mutual traumas of entertainers Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald, to the unlikely admiration between visionaries Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla, each episode of Obituaries digs deep into the lasting impressions made between two legendary figures and how their entanglements changed the course of history. These meaningful duos may have passed on, but the profound effect they had on each other and us will live on forever. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Obituaries. Listen free only on Spotify.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, back to the story.
Just hours after Joseph Bowne Elwell's murder, dozens of newspaper reporters crowded around his house in Manhattan. They were desperate to get the details on what was sure to be a sensational crime.
The New York Daily News dramatically described the scene by saying,
"A score or more of reporters and photographers graced the vicinity. Some of the reporters seemed very edgy. One wonders if among them there may be some Edgar Allan Poe who will reconstruct the truth about the tragedy and bring the murderer to justice."
Unfortunately, the reporter's hope that a journalist would solve the crime was overly optimistic. From the beginning, newspapers were much more concerned with scandalous details than important clues.
It was an open secret that Joseph was a womanizer. This suspicion was only increased when detectives found lingerie in the closet of Joseph's guest bedroom. It didn't take long before the intimate details of the underwear appeared on front pages around the city.
The press seemed determined to turn even the most innocent of evidence into salacious news. When detectives discovered an address book in Joseph's bedroom, reporters had a field day. They quickly dubbed the little booklet Joseph's Love List.
Some newspapers reported there were over 400 women in the book. Others claimed there were 52, the same number as cards in a deck.
Unfortunately, journalists were so eager for facts, they were making up their own. The love list was a complete fabrication. The actual address book included contact information for both men and women, and was not a list of Joseph's mistresses.
But the book of names did come in handy. Joseph was a social butterfly, and Captain Walsh planned to interview just about every contact in that book about their connection to the victim.
As luck would have it, one of Joseph's good friends accidentally beat Walsh to it by calling Joseph's phone as police still combed for clues.
Someone get that!
Mr. Elwell's residence.
Is Joseph in?
Who's calling?
Walter Lewison.
Lewison. And what is this in regards to?
Joe said last night he wanted to drive to the country with us. We were going to pick him up around 1, but we haven't heard from him.
Are you a friend of Mr. Elwell's?
Yes, Who is this?
This is the police, and if you're a friend of Mr. Elwell's, I advise you to get down here right away.
Walter and Selma Lewison arrived with Viola Krause in tow around 2 p.m. on June 11th. They claim that the last time they saw Joseph was at 1:30 the night before. The three people all maintained they were together the rest of the night and morning. They would serve as each other's alibis.
After some grilling, Viola admitted that she and Joseph had a small argument over dinner the previous night. She also confessed that she had called Joseph around 2:30 in the morning and had a short conversation with him.
Despite her suspicious behavior, Captain Walsh crossed Viola off the suspect list. Because of Walter Lewison's wealth and clout, his statement was not questioned. The police took his word that Viola was with him all night and morning.
Instead, investigators turned their attention to a different part of Viola's story. She said Joseph had bumped into Viola's ex-husband, Victor von Schlegel, on the night of his death.
Victor had a woman with him at the time and had acted cordially to Viola and Joseph. Nevertheless, detectives thought Victor was a possible suspect. Perhaps the ex-husband had been so jealous of Joseph, he had killed him in a rage.
When the police arrived at Victor's Manhattan apartment that night, he was nowhere to be found. The manager of a nearby garage told detectives that just a few hours earlier, Victor had urgently readied his car for a last-minute trip to Atlantic City.
Captain Walsh wondered if Victor was a criminal running from his crime. Soon, detectives were staking out the man's business and home.
When Victor arrived back in New York City on June 12th, he had no idea the police were searching for him. He told Captain Walsh the trip to Atlantic City had been a business trip planned days before Joseph's murder.
If the detectives had asked anyone at Victor's company of his whereabouts, they could have told them the same. But Captain Walsh and his team could never manage to ask the right questions.
Once it had been established that Victor had not been running away, the detectives asked for his alibi for the morning of June 11th. He explained that he was in bed with his date from the Ariel Gardens. He told police the woman's name, but begged them not to release it to the press.
The papers went wild over Victor's sensational interview. Soon, Victor's date was known as the Woman in Black. Every journalist was desperate to know the lady's identity, even though she almost certainly had nothing to do with Joseph's death.
When Victor's date was finally found, she confirmed Victor's story. With that confession, Victor von Schlegel was no longer a suspect, and the police again had no leads.
The detectives continued interviewing Joseph's friends and acquaintances, and so did the papers. Joseph's estranged wife, Helen Derby Elwell, was more than happy to give the press a statement about Joseph.
Vanity and bad rearing account for his peculiar behavior. His gambling and racing activities ruined our domestic happiness. He chased the phantom of impossibilities. Each new face was a new possibility for Joe. He was a chicken chaser.
Helen's claim that Joseph went after younger women was just the kind of salacious news the press wanted. Rumors ran wild in the papers, with reporters speculating why Joseph may have been killed. Joseph was accused of having massive debts, of being a bootlegger, an adulterer, and even a spy.
The reports on Joseph's gambling got so bad that Joseph's father, Joseph Sanford Elwell, decided he needed to come forward to defend his son's legacy. In an interview, he said,
"Joseph Bowne Elwell was the best son anyone could have in the world. He always provided well for his mother and me in his advancing years, and he was considerate. He was entirely self-made. We had little to give him. All racing the like is a gamble. Why single him out as bad if he made large sums on his horses?"
As press coverage became more and more unhinged, the pressure to solve the case only grew. Captain Walsh desperately ordered a second and third search of Joseph's home.
The third time was the charm. On June 12th, a detective discovered a pink silk negligee stuffed into a nondescript cardboard box in Joseph's closet. It appeared that the lingerie had been hidden on purpose. Even more suspicious, a small square of fabric on the left chest had been cut out of the garment, exactly where monogrammed initials would have been.
Captain Walsh suspected that Marie Larson had stashed the garment to protect the honor of her boss and one of his mistresses. The captain immediately set up an interview with Marie.
You hid that garment, didn't you, Mrs. Larson?
So what if I did?
What else did you hide?
Nothing. I hid nothing else.
Did this woman ask you to hide the clothes?
No.
Why did you do it then?
I don't need to explain myself to you.
Let me remind you, Mrs. Larson, that you are not currently being considered a suspect. If you choose to not cooperate, that may change.
I didn't want Mr. Elwell's name to be dragged through the mud. But you police and those papers have already done a good job of that.
The mysterious negligee became known as the pink kimono in the press, who seemingly did not care that it was not, in fact, a kimono. The police tried to hide the identity of the negligee-wearing woman by giving her the moniker Miss Wilson.
But despite the police's efforts at modesty, journalists quickly figured out that Miss Wilson was actually Viola Krause. As soon as Viola's name hit the papers, dubious allegations came flying in.
One of Joseph's old housekeepers emerged and accused Viola of threatening Joseph's life. She claimed that Viola was upset at Joseph for not fully divorcing from his wife, Helen.
Viola was sick of seeing her reputation destroyed, so she held a heated press conference to defend her honor.
That housekeeper is a shocking liar! I was never deserted by Joseph, and never feared that I would be. Mr. Elwell never proposed to me, and I never suggested he should have. I have never quarreled over Mr. Elwell with any women or men, for that matter.
Viola Krause was far from the last woman dragged into Joseph's murder case. Captain Walsh's search also turned up a photograph of two beautiful Polish women, Countess Sonia Deszczynska and her sister Amelia.
The ladies were soon identified and asked to make a statement. And as it turned out, the newspaper reports about Joseph being a spy were not as far off as they seemed.
And how did you ladies come to know Mr. Elwell?
We met Joseph in Carlsbad, Germany, in 1913. We saw each other every once in a while, but I haven't seen him in over a year.
Last time I saw Joe was in Palm Beach, about 2 years ago.
Why haven't you seen him in so long? Was there any sort of disagreement?
Oh, not at all. But I suppose I should tell you. During the war, I was detained for 2 months as a suspected spy. I, of course, wasn't, but my sister and I were told that Joseph had been the one to accuse me.
Well, at the end of the day, that was nothing more than gossip. When I asked Joseph about it, he denied having any part in my sister's detainment. In fact, he sent a personal letter to the capital to ask for my sister's release.
I am very grateful for Mr. Elwell. It's terrible that he's gone.
During World War I, Joseph was a member of the American Protective League. The APL was an organization of private American citizens who worked with the federal government to identify German sympathizers and labor union leaders.
Walsh thought that maybe the Countess suspected that Joseph really had called her a spy, and his murder was a long overdue act of revenge.
Although the lead was intriguing, Captain Walsh ultimately dropped the Countess and her sister as suspects. The motive was too far-fetched, and their alibis were strong.
Walsh and his detectives interviewed several other female acquaintances as the days wore on. Joseph's lady friends ranged from an Egyptian princess to a working-class masseuse, but they were all dead ends.
By now, Joseph's womanizing seemed even more important to papers than his murder. The scandal was the top story in New York City for over a week. It even found its way into church sermons.
Tonight, as we stand in the shadow of the Elwell tragedy, which has stunned the city, I wish to press home to every mind and heart the lessons to be drawn from it. The Elwell tragedy has in it every element of degradation and social decay this age knows. The most acute and menacing malady is the abnormal overdevelopment of sex consciousness. Sexitis caused the death of Joseph Bown Elwell.
While the made-up condition of sexitis certainly didn't cause Joseph's death, his numerous secret flings could have earned him some enemies.
Joseph's chauffeur insinuated that his boss's adultery was what had killed him. Joseph's business partner said that he was sleeping with over 50 women. But Captain Walsh quickly found that neither of these men had proof to back up their claims. His case was going nowhere.
As the investigation limped along, the chances of finding the murderer became less and less likely. But soon, Manhattan's district attorney would declare that they were closing in on a suspect.
The only problem was, he was lying.
Up next, we'll examine the messy end to the investigation and try to solve the case ourselves. And now, back to the story.
47-year-old Joseph Bown Elwell was buried at Vallow Cemetery in Ridgewood, New Jersey on June 15, 1920. Because of all the press around Joseph's murder, Joseph's body had to be snuck out of the Manhattan morgue and secretly transported to Ridgewood's funeral parlor.
The funeral was a rare moment of solitude for Joseph's family, who had been hounded by journalists in the days since his death. The group included Joseph's father and mother, his siblings, and surprisingly, his estranged wife, Helen, and their son, Richard.
Although Helen previously only had said bad things about Joseph, her tune changed as soon as she heard the dead man's will. Joseph left his entire estate to his parents instead of his son. Helen was now determined to get on her in-law's good side for the sake of her child.
Theoretically, Helen had a lot to gain from Joseph's death, but detectives never seriously thought of her as a suspect. Captain Walsh claimed that after checking Helen's alibi, it was impossible for her to have been at the scene of the crime on the morning of June 11th. It was now 4 days after Joseph's murder, and the police still didn't have anything close to a viable suspect.
Despite the lack of leads, or perhaps because of it, the press was still consumed by Joseph's murder, as the New York Times reported on June 16th.
About 25,000 persons yesterday visited the block where the Elwell House is located. Several traffic patrolmen were on duty at both ends of the block to regulate the motor cars attracted to the neighborhood of the murder. The detectives have been consistently annoyed with all sorts of cranks going into the house to volunteer their services in solving the mystery.
Manhattan's DA, 58-year-old Edward Swan, tried his best to rein in the investigation and out-of-control press. Even Swan's own department was chaotic. Two assistant district attorneys in his office were so desperate for fame, they constantly spoke to the press about their half-baked theories and contradicted themselves on a daily basis.
By June 16th, Swan had had enough. At a press conference, the district attorney announced that he was the only official that was allowed to talk to the press. Unfortunately, newspapers were not interested in Swan's more factual presentation of the murder case. Instead, they kept getting their information from other, less reliable sources.
Swan was determined to find Joseph Elwell's murderer, but sadly, it seemed like viable leads in the case had dried up. Swan's hopeless task was certainly not helped by the many useless tips his office received on a daily basis.
District Attorney's Office?
Mr. Swan, I have an important lead in the Joseph Elwell case.
Go on.
I was told it was a woman who killed him.
Is that right? Who told you that?
Well, I consulted my Ouija board. It was very clear on the matter.
Your Ouija board? Well, you can tell the spirits not to bother me anymore. Don't call here again.
District Attorney Swan was not the sort of man who would take evidence from ghosts. He needed his leads to come from the living. Luckily, on June 17th, he got exactly that.
A local telephone operator told investigators that two phone calls had been made from Joseph Elwell's home a few hours before Joseph was shot. On June 11th, someone had attempted a call at 1:45 a.m. and at 2:04 a.m., staying on the line for 9 minutes each time before hanging up.
Both times, the caller was dialing William Pendleton, Joseph's ex-business partner. William had previously claimed that he had not spoken to Joseph in over 8 months, but that seems unlikely if Joseph tried to call him two times in the dead of night.
In his second statement to the police, William chose his words carefully.
My telephone is on a small table between my bed and Mrs. Pendleton's bed. The phone did not ring at any time on the morning in question. It simply could not have rung without waking my wife or myself. I have no idea why Mr. Elwell would attempt to call me at such an hour. For the record, my earlier statement that I had not seen Joseph in 8 months is incorrect. I now remember some casual meetings we had in the time since.
Although William had greatly revised his story since the day of the murder, he still denied having any idea who killed Joseph. His wife backed his alibi that he was at home asleep the morning of June 11th, but investigators attempted to poke holes in that story.
A few days later, William left for a short vacation. On June 28th, the New York Times front page announced, "Elwell suspect disappears."
When William Pendleton read that headline, he was flabbergasted. He had told District Attorney Swan in person that he planned to go to Saratoga Springs for a few days. Apparently, the papers missed that particular detail.
Rushing back to the city, an upset William held yet another press conference.
If this whole thing were not so serious, it would be the damnedest joke I ever saw. Of course, it is serious, but the whole thing is a fiasco. I have answered all the questions I've been able to. If they ask me any more questions, I think I'll go crazy.
A few days later, Edward Swan dropped William Pendleton as a suspect. William was right. The investigation was a complete farce. They were nowhere close to solving it.
Still, Edward Swan and his office continued lying to the press, saying that an arrest of the murderer was imminent. That arrest never came.
On June 27th, the DA's office proudly announced they were on the trail of the murderer, but the very next day, Edward Swan admitted defeat.
After 18 days, neither my office nor the police have anybody we can point at with suspicion. We have got 1,001 collateral details, but on the main issue, the evidence is completely devoid of any fact that would justify us accusing any man or woman.
After that statement, the investigation into Joseph Elwell's murder was unceremoniously closed. Eventually, the press moved on to other juicy stories, and the mystery around Joseph's death was just a memory.
As the years bore on, many others tried to solve the case. In 1950, Esquire magazine wrote an exposé on Joseph Elwell's murder. The article guessed that Joseph's death might indeed have been a suicide. Joseph's housekeeper, Marie Larson, admitting to hiding the negligee to protect her boss's honor. Marie might have hidden a gun for the same reason.
While the exposé offered no proof to back up the claim, it set up a very intriguing possibility that the investigation into Joseph's death had been such a wild goose chase because it wasn't even a murder at all.
In 1987, Joseph Bowne Elwell's biographer, Jonathan Goodman, proposed a new theory focused on Joseph's good friend, Walter Lewison. A short time after Joseph's death, Walter became mentally ill. Walter was institutionalized in 1923 and was declared incurably insane 2 years later.
Many of Walter's delusions centered on vaudeville dancer Leonora Hughes. Walter had been obsessed with Leonora long before Joseph's death, and Joseph had flirted with her in front of Walter several times. Goodman's book theorized that Walter killed Joseph out of jealousy.
While Goodman doesn't have any hard evidence, he suggested that because Walter was Joseph's good friend, he may have had a spare set of keys to his brownstone. Also, Joseph would allow very few people to see him without his toupee and dentures, and perhaps Walter was one of those people.
Unfortunately, there is little actual proof in Goodman's theory.
Joseph Bowne Elwell's unsolved murder inspired many mystery writers throughout the years. The case was a major influence for S.S. Van Dyne's novel, The Benson Murder Case, and several mystery novels by Ellery Queen. Joseph Bowne Elwell's life and death were also said to have inspired F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. But despite the ongoing interest in Joseph's murder, the mystery of his death was never solved.
So, with all that said, I believe William Pendleton was somehow involved in Joseph's death. He lied several times to the police, and he seemed overly defensive at times.
Yeah, I see why you think that, but I actually disagree. I think Viola Krause had more motive to kill Joseph, if he did indeed lie to her about getting married. She also acted suspiciously after Joseph's death.
Whatever the truth may be, the publicity around Joseph Bowne Elwell's death is often considered the origin of America's appetite for murder mysteries, a fascination that continues to this day.
Thanks again for tuning in to Unsolved Murders. We'll be back next Tuesday with a new episode. For more information on Joseph Bowne Elwell, amongst the many sources we used, we found The Slaying of Joseph Bowne Elwell by Jonathan Goodman extremely helpful to our research.
You can find all episodes of Unsolved Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
We'll see you next time.
If we live till next time.
Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories is a Spotify original from Parcast. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Unsolved Murders was written by Matt Hartman, with writing assistance by Giles Hofseth and River Donahue. Fact-checking by Cheyenne Lopez, and research by Mickey Taylor. The amazing cast of voice actors includes Tiana Camacho, Joe Hernandez, Kai Jordan, Albert Park, and Laura Faye Smith. Unsolved Murders stars Wendy McKenzie and Carter Roy.
Hi, it's Vanessa from Parcast. If you enjoy our in-depth profiles on historical figures and famous fates, you'll love my new limited series, Obituaries. Every Wednesday on Spotify, join me and my co-host Carter as we explore the unlikely bonds forged between two meaningful figures from the past and discover how those relationships impacted the future. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Obituaries. Listen weekly, free, and only on Spotify.